Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
As we continue to follow the latest news about Charlottesville and the president's comments on the subject, we want to look back now at the history of white supremacist activity in the U.S. We're joined by Nathan Connolly and Ed Ayers, both history professors and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Ed, let me start with you. We could have a whole conversation about slavery, but let's talk today about what happened afterwards. When was the first surge in white supremacist activity in the U.S.?
Well, it begins right after the Civil War. The Ku Klux Klan is born basically in the smoking rubble of the Confederacy. The idea is that there is lawlessness and that white men are going to restore law, by which they mean complete unchallenged white supremacy. But that is then crushed during Reconstruction and fades away in the 1880s and 1890s, but makes a surging comeback, as unlikely as it seems, triggered by a movie, Birth of a Nation, in 1915, and they go to Stone Mountain and Atlanta and burn a cross and rebirth the Ku Klux Klan.
And then I guess the next wave would have been in the 50s, and this is the one that a lot of our listeners may have actually remembered and lived through.
So after the Supreme Court decision in Brown versus the Board of Education in 1954 and then implementation in 55, you begin to see a push for really overt racial desegregation in America. And that leads to a moment that many know as the era of massive resistance. And massive resistance is kind of a crossroads in that you have earlier articulations of Klan and kind of pro-Confederate imagery matched with a much more genteel kind of shirt and tie kind of racism that is invested in property rights and school boundaries and kind of the technical stuff of urban politics.
You know, it's interesting to think that Virginia was the leading state that followed this kind of genteel resistance. And Charlottesville was one of the cities in Virginia that shut down its schools rather than integrate them. So there is this tension that we saw this last weekend has been sort of reverberating here for a long time.
As you know, President Trump has been criticized for his initial silence on what was happening in Charlottesville, and he didn't specifically call out white supremacists when he first made comments to the public. How have past presidents responded to the KKK and other expressions of white supremacy?
There's always been a kind of tension between these high national offices and these hate groups, right? And it's never really been the case that American presidents have been able to fully embrace them for all kinds of reasons, including their willingness to act extra legally and including some of their more overt public statements that many consider rightfully, I suppose, to be anti-democratic. I think it's also important to bear in mind, though, that many politicians became very good at knowing how to offer a kind of wink and a nod to members of the electorate that might have believed themselves to be more in line with some of these white supremacist groups, right? So just as one concrete example, President Ronald Reagan, in the launching of his campaign in the early 1980s, really late 1970s, began campaigning at the Neshoba County Fairgrounds. And Neshoba County was famously the site where Freedom Summer activists were killed in the mid-1960s. And Reagan knew that he could reach into the South and kind of mobilize white working class sentiment there by basically saying that he was in favor of states' rights with that kind of launching. Again, famously in the late 1980s and early 90s, Republican Party politics were also, again, dog whistling on race, sometimes winking and nodding to overt racial groups, but never really stepping into a formal acceptance or even, you know, soft condemnation of those groups. Most statements from the White House tended to at least be condemning of Klan and neo-Nazi chapters, if not necessarily other kinds of white nationalism.
So what we're seeing from President Trump right now is very different, is what you're saying, from what we've seen from presidents in the past in terms of how they're dealing with these groups.
It certainly seems so to me that there have been sort of a steady decline. And obviously, during the Obama years, the pivot is remarkable, how quickly this new kind of language and signaling seems to be.
The thing about Trump's speech as well is, I mean, he took a lot of heat for his remark about things being kind of violent or volatile on many sides, the on many sides phrase. In that remark alone, there was a lot that was similar to earlier presidential utterances that tended to believe that, you know, black nationalism and white nationalism were, for instance, equally out of bounds, that anybody who was part of the radical left, that was as it was perceived to be, was just as dangerous as people perceived to be on the radical right. So even in a moment where it was clear that the kind of outrage was one-sided, Trump's use of somewhat equivocal language seemed to put him out of bounds.
One of the other aspects of what we're seeing right now is anti-Semitism. Take us back to some of the history of that in the U.S. and how it got merged in with this white supremacist movement as well.
You know, we've been talking about sort of the tangled roots of the manifestations of white supremacy that we saw in Charlottesville. Here's a case where the roots are deeply entangled on both sides. The Ku Klux Klan identified Jews and Catholics as enemies of the nation. And in the 1920s, you would have seen anti-Catholicism being as prominently featured in some places as anti-African-American language. But anti-Semitism has been sort of a steady beat through all this. And obviously, the neo-Nazis were picking up on the themes coming out of Germany. So I'd see the recent events as a convergence of two traditions. What do you think, Nathan?
Yeah, absolutely. The kind of taint of anti-Semitism was really bound to, at many turns, an anti-immigrant sentiment, an anti-black sentiment. And, you know, it's not unlikely or not surprising, I should say, to see now this very strange collapsing that Ed is pointing to, where you have Klan imagery, which is from an earlier period, neo-Nazi imagery, which is from a later period, basically becoming part of this mashup of white nationalist symbolism in a place like Charlottesville. There's also, though, a fourth tradition that people tend to forget about, which is that of the old White Citizens Council, right? Those are the elite whites who in the South didn't really don hoods, but they were much more concerned with low taxes and property rights, and they used a kind of genteel political form in order to keep African Americans in confined spaces. And that politic, too, I would argue, is on display in a place like Charlottesville, you know, where you had a number of people who were very elite and well-educated who were part of this overt demonstration of white nationalism.
Also on display in Charlottesville is something that has caused a lot of angst across the South, which is a statue that is a memorial to the Confederacy. And I wonder, first of all, why there are so many of these statues across the South still today, and have they always been so controversial?
The statues that we see today largely grew up between 1890 and 1920. That was the heyday. And it was also the heyday of statue building in the North as well, partly because veterans are dying and people want to memorialize them. But it was also the time when the South, firmly in control of the voting system, of segregation, is free to put up monuments to whatever it wants to. And it puts up monuments to what it considers the glorious lost cause of the Confederacy, in which it's called the lost cause because they were up against such large odds, they said. They could not have won, so they must have been fighting for some high ideal. And so the statue in Charlottesville is actually a little bit out of the ordinary. It's put up in 1924 after being commissioned in 1917. But across the South, you would see these statues that have basically been put up 35, 40, even 50 years after the Civil War to kind of stake out the territory as being under the control of the former Confederates.
And when did they become so controversial and people wanted to rip them down?
That's actually quite recently, in the sense of being publicly controversial. They've always been seen as symbols of white supremacy by African Americans. And you can go back and look at the quotations in the newspapers when, say, that they were first put up, and the editorials say, we know what these are, and we think it's a travesty to be using public land and public monies to put these up. But I don't know, Nathan. It seems to me that what we're seeing now with the great turn against the statues is in some ways a distillate of the controversies over the Confederate flag that sort of reached their peak with the Dillon Roof shooting.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's no question that a lot changed once the presidency was desegregated with the election of Barack Obama. And there was a backlash, and there was similarly a kind of recognition that you needed to start reinterpreting the public iconography about the country's heritage. So in the case of someone like Dylann Roof, a lone gunman with a patch about a Confederate flag, that began to raise all kinds of new questions. That, again, old questions, but also new questions about whether or not the Confederate flag should be on the grounds of the State House in South Carolina. And certainly around the other kinds of images of the old Confederacy, particularly the statues, but other kinds of historical landmarks. I mean, there's always a question about the meaning of public history. And that's one of the things that I think is really powerful about this moment now and what the country is basically invested in, is that you had in Charlottesville over the weekend, you know, in spite of how you may have felt about the demonstration and the torches and the other kinds of, you know, mashup of symbols, that was a moment of public history, right? The people in the street were making an argument about the country's heritage in some kind of way. In response, people are now taking down more Confederate statues in places like Durham, North Carolina and elsewhere, right? I mean, this is a conversation that's happening in bronze and marble and tiki torches right now. It's going to require a lot of really tough work in having discussions about the meaning of the country and the meaning of these symbols and its history in wide public open forums.
Well, that's why it's good that we have you guys here to help us bring the history to what's going on today. Nathan Connolly and Ed Ayers, history professors and hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.